Wait for it, wait for it. Welcome to the BerlinBrigade.com podcast with your host, David Guerra.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 21 of the BerlinBrigade.com podcast. As always, I am your host, Dave Guerra, and I thank you for taking the time to join me today on this latest episode of the BerlinBrigade.com podcast. This episode is being recorded on Sunday, June 13th, just having witnessed Germany give Australia a 4-0 defeat in their first match of the 2010 World Cup in South Africa. Plenty of good times still to come, so if you get a chance, be sure to check out the remaining games.
It's time for the special announcements!
As of this recording, we have over 3,600 registry entries on record. Wow, cool. That's awesome. So keep those registries coming in, those entries, keep them coming in. There are plenty of great connections and reconnections being made, and I know this how, because, hey, people write me, they tell me, Dave, I've met an old friend, we got to talking. It's awesome. So, hey, keep it happening. If you know somebody out there that was in the brigade and hasn't registered, let them know. It's real easy, it's painless, and above all, it's free. And there's nothing wrong with that, especially in this current economy. But, hey, I digress. You know, there's going to come a time, and there's going to come a time you will see fit to be removed from the registry. For whatever reason, it's your reason, that's okay. I'm not going to question it. I'll hate to see you go. Everybody else will hate to see you go, but that's okay. And all you need to do is send an email from the email address that's already on record. That way we know it's you and not somebody else acting as you or pretending to be you, but it's you. So send it from the email address we have on record and ask to be removed, and as soon as humanly possible, your info will be removed from the registry. And let's see what else. Yes, last time I talked about the Cinch Cast, well, they continue, and on June 1st of this month, I actually started a new series with the Cinch Cast. It's called the Cold War Minute, and collecting data from various sources. I take about a minute, a little bit more sometimes, a little bit less, depending on what's going on, but it's about the Cold War and any events based on the Cold War or directly influenced with the Cold War that happened on that particular day. Now, if you haven't checked it out, I invite you to do so. Earlier, I mentioned to check out the FIFA World Cup games when you can. There's plenty of great games still going on. But I also invite you to check out the links on the BerlinBrigade.com homepage to the History Channel's newest reality show, Top Shot, every Sunday night at 10 p.m. Started off with like 16 people, 15 men, one female, and they're like the top shots in whatever weapon that they use. And they go through this course, and let's see, the first week was like old weapons starting from like World War One all the way up to the current. And rifles, that's what that was, and that was pretty cool. The second episode dealt with pistols, so that was even awesome. So hey, check it out. A lot of great stuff's on tap, so it looks like a pretty decent show. And again, it's a different type of reality show. They get to shoot at things. So hey, the potential exists that somebody could shoot somebody else, but that's beside the point. We're not there to watch that, or are we? It's like those car races. People tune in for the accidents. Okay. Hey, listen, let's move on. In the inbox corner, the following messages have arrived. I received an email looking for Jim Adminson. Now, he's on the registry, but the email address needs to be updated. It's apparently an old buddy prior to Berlin is trying to make contact with Jim. So if you are Jim Adminson or you know Jim Adminson, please let Jim Adminson know to update his email address. Somebody's looking for you. I know they email me. They're looking for you. So, hey, let's get it updated. Folks, speaking of updating it, there are currently on the registry at least 70 entries that need their email address updated. One just sent me an email, says, hey, here's my updated email address. That's fine. But what I really want you to do is when you get a chance, please verify that your email address is up to date. And if not, please fill out the registry submission form. In the comments section, write change of email address. That's it. That's all you really need to do. And I'll hunt you down on that list. I'll find it, and we'll make the changes, and you're off and running. I also received an email from someone looking for other members of the first... No, this is it. Listen to this. The first Berlin Brigade Volunteer Army. Now, not too sure about this one. So if anyone out there can provide a little bit more information about what the first Berlin Brigade Volunteer Army is all about, please let me know. It'd be greatly appreciated. And lastly, in the email, an email request for information that pops up every now and then, and it's greatly appreciated because there's some interest still out there, and we really want to know and it's just one of those things. So we're going to put it out there again. Let's see who can help us. This one just came in literally this week, so great timing. And we're looking for anyone that has more specific information on the woman that was known as Four Ring Annie. If anyone can provide a little more information on Four Ring Annie, who she was, how she became Four Ring Annie, and what status she had on McNair, we want to see if we can turn this quickly, bring this back to less legend and more truth-based information, because this Four Ring Annie is quickly achieving this legend status. And let's see if we can put some truth to the legend and get that under control. So again, if anyone has a little more information on Four Ring Annie, it would be greatly appreciated. Send it on over, davidg@berlinbrigade.com. davidg@berlinbrigade.com. And let's get this under control. Let's see, closing out the special announcement section here, I want to pass along to everyone I know that there are still reunions and mini reunions and other Berlin Brigade related events happening all over the United States and in Berlin. So if you want to spread the word about those events, either drop me a note at davidg@berlinbrigade.com or send me an email and say, hey, we'll get you on a podcast and we'll do this real quickly and then we'll just get you back on here. Don't forget, we're getting really close to the BUS MVA, the Berlin U.S. Military Veterans Association's reunion in Berlin this coming August. So again, let's get this under control. So again, drop me a note. You got something going on, something in the fall, something in or before the holidays, during the holidays, after the holidays, whenever. Remember, it's a reunion when three or more people get together. Because when two people get together, well, that's just two people getting together, some old army buddy. But when three or more people get together, it's a reunion. So there you go. There's your minimum requirement for mini reunions and reunions. Other than that, you know what? I think that does it for the special announcements.
Take your seats because it's time for the special guest interview.
Before we start the next guest interview here at the BerlinBrigade.com podcast, I want to take some time to thank our last guest, Donna Musel, for taking time to share with us. I hope you had as much fun listening to the interview as we had putting it together. It certainly was awesome. And again, thank you, Donna. But now we've got to move on. This is episode 21, and our guest in this episode is Bob Johnson, a former member of the 298th Army Band, who was with the band until an unfortunate incident with a trombone that changed his vocation with the Berlin Brigade. But I will let Bob tell you all about that and a whole bunch of other stuff. Joining us today for the BerlinBrigade.com podcast interview is our very special guest, Robert Johnson, saxophonist with the 298th Army Band in Berlin from July 1973 to June 1980, and he was assigned a very special duty. He was with the Public Information Office as a photojournalist for the Berlin Observer, the Army Times, and the Stars and Stripes. Bob, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, very pleasured to be here.
All righty. Well, listen, let's just go right into this. First of all, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you joined the military, what got you in, and what got you sent to Berlin. What did you do?
I was 17 years old at the time, going to South Philadelphia High School down there in South Philadelphia, of course. And I played a saxophone, and that's basically all I had ever done in life. And I never really learned anything else. And I wanted to be a professional musician. But those were the days where if you were a guitarist or a drummer, you had a good chance of becoming a musician. But if you played a saxophone, that was a whole nother thing, as they say. And so right out of high school, after I graduated, I had already been talking to an Army recruiter. And they told me, oh, yeah, we have the Army bands, and, you know, you come in, audition. And I said, oh, okay. So I went in, and I auditioned with the 19th Army Band at Fort Dix, New Jersey. And the bandmaster there was Anthony Stacchini, and he was an old brown shoer. He was in the Second World War and stuff. And he auditioned me and thought I was good enough. I couldn't believe it. He thought I was good enough to go right from basic training right into the band in what they back then they referred to as OJT, or on-the-job training. And it was great. Ever since then, you know, I had to go through basic training, which was a rude awakening for me, as it is for everybody. And after that, I went right into the 19th Army Band. And the funny thing with bandsmen is you don't get a whole lot of training on the drill and ceremony of these particular ceremonies, as it were. And so you have to learn kind of like on the fly. And so, you know, it was the greatest opportunity in the world for me to become a professional musician without having to go through the hully gully of competing with other people. I mean, I was joining a band. It was more like a team type thing. And I just enjoyed it thoroughly. Then I was at Fort Dix, and I had come down on orders. Well, what we used to call a levy back then, to go to Vietnam, and not just once, but a couple times. And the CO, as I had mentioned, that I had from the old Brown Shoe Army, he said there was no way he was going to send a 17-year-old kid to Vietnam. And so what he did was, and this guy, I mean, he was a W-4, but he had just as much weight as a 4-star general. This, I mean, because he had so many political contacts. And he got me out of each and every one of those levies. And I told him, hey, I don't mind going to Vietnam. It's no big deal. And he said, no, I won't be responsible for what might befall you there. And I'm like, but you won't be. He argued with me, and I'm glad he did, because I finally came down on a levy to go to Germany. It wasn't really a direct assignment to Berlin. It was just to go to Germany. So I went to the Gutleut Kaserne in Frankfurt. Maybe a lot of the listeners have been there. Very old place, I should say. Very old. It just reminded me of the Second World War as soon as I got there. And I was there for about 2 weeks when they finally got the call from Berlin saying they needed a saxophone player at the 298th. And they asked me if I'd like to go. And I said, well, that's a big city. I said, sure, I'll go there. And about 10 minutes later, I'm standing underneath a map of Germany. And there was this Sergeant First Class standing next to me. And I had asked him how often he had been to Germany. He said, oh, this is like my fourth time here. He said, I spent a lot of years in Germany. It's really great. And I had asked him, I said, well, where is Berlin on this map? I've been looking for a few minutes, and I cannot find Berlin on this map. What is up? And he said, well, that's a map of the Federal Republic of Germany. And I said, yeah, so shouldn't Berlin be in there? He said, well, Berlin is in the German Democratic Republic, really. And then it hit me like a ton of bricks. Oh my God, that's right, Berlin, the divided city, the wall. And I was just amazed at how, you know, all that stuff I had forgotten about. And here I was going to walk into the middle of history. And I thought that was so cool. And you know, I got to Berlin. I went on the duty train. I didn't come in through Tempelhof. I went in via the duty train. And, of course, that in and of itself just everything. I was transformed. Now, I wasn't alive during the Second World War. Don't get me wrong. But, I mean, you see movies and everything. You kind of get a feeling for what it was. And doing all that just reminded me so much of World War II and the time, because here we are on these old trains with the whistles, the toot toot whistles, and you know, it was man, it was just so cool. And there I was on the they didn't even know I was coming in. I had to go up to a duty NCO and say, hey, listen, I'm sitting here waiting for somebody to come and pick me up from the 298th Army Band. Is there any way? He says, oh, these band people, they forget about stuff all the time. He says, you just stand right here. And he called the CQ down there, and somebody came about an hour later to pick me up. And I went to the band, and I was just so amazed. Everything, see, in most bands, you have several buildings. You know, there'd be a building where people would sleep, that, of course, the barracks. And then there'd be another building that would hold the orderly room, and another building, the rehearsal hall, and another building, this. And, you know, the day room might be 6 miles down the road. So a lot of bands have all these buildings all over the place, whereas the 298th, everything was in one building. I thought that was just the best. And so, I mean, you woke up in the morning, and I was single when I first arrived in Berlin. And you woke up in the morning, you put on your boots, you went downstairs, you did your usual, what do we call it back in the military, formations. You did your formation, then afterwards you went into rehearsals and whatnot. And it was great fun. I really, really enjoyed it. Of course, back then we had, I would say, close to three quarters of the band were draftees. And some of them weren't even originally slated to be bandsmen. Some of them came from McNair Barracks out of the 6th Infantry. And all good guys, don't get me wrong. I'm not belittling our draftees, because some of them were really, really great. But they weren't, you know, bandsmen that came through the traditional pipeline. But then again, neither was I, being an OJT person. But... of course, these guys had their own mindset about the military, and with me, here I was. Well, when I landed in Berlin, I was finally 19 years old. I was no longer 17, so I wasn't the youngest person on the block anymore. But I still used to get teased, you know, that, hey, what are you doing in the Army? You didn't have to join the Army. But that was all right. And you know, the things in Berlin, I mean, one thing, like I said, I liked was the building, and the fact that the rehearsal hall was right there, the orderly room. We even had an arms room, if you can believe that, a band with an arms room. In fact, I think it was the only band in the entire world that had its own arms room. And I mean, I had a rifle assigned to me, had a gas mask assigned, had an NBC suit assigned to me. I was like, oh no, I'm back in the military. And a lot of people don't realize that. They go, oh, you were in the band. And I have to tell them, hey, listen, being in the band is just, it just means I do everything that you do. Plus, I carry a saxophone and I have to perform that. I said, and I'm lucky. I could have been a pianist. That was my standard joke. Don't want to carry a piano on your back. But while I was doing that, something had happened. A trombone player was fooling around one day, and you might think, well, this is typical. But, you know, you know how the trombone is. It's a very loud instrument when it's played at volume. And this one guy came up behind me. I did not know he was there. And all of a sudden, he let go with one of those type things. But he did it, my God, so loud. It did something to my ear, and I couldn't hear out of my right ear for quite a while afterwards. And so after about the fourth day, I had become worried about it, so I went on sick call and went up to the old Army hospital. I don't know if anybody recalls that, but back in the 70s, that hospital was, it looked like something from out of a Dr. Frankenstein movie. But I went there, and they even kept me in the hospital for a week trying to find out what was wrong. And because without that right ear, it was tough for me to play. It was just so different, the sound and all. So I ended up not playing in the band anymore, and they were going to reassign me to a desk job up at BB headquarters, you know, push paper around. And I go, oh, come on, who the heck wants to do that? That's not interesting. And Colonel Guard, I don't remember his whole name, but his name was Colonel Guard. He was a lieutenant colonel out of, he had just left Berlin Brigade as the public information officer, and he transferred, well, not transferred, but he got the command of what was known as Special Troops Battalion back then. It eventually became Combat Support Battalion. But at the time, it was still Special Troops Battalion. And when he had found out that I was going to have to do that, he went, no way. He said, this guy takes some awesome photographs. Because when I was in the band, I used to take a lot of pictures, promotional pictures for the band, you know, in front of the various places in Berlin and whatnot. In fact, the last album we had cut when I was... the last album I had cut, I should say, with the band. Two or three of the pictures on the back of the album were taken by me, in addition to that one famous one that you always see where they had just blown off the swastika off the top of what we used to have as a snack bar. I used to say, I can't remember now, but in German, it basically, it was the Adolf Hitler's bodyguards were trained there. And it used to be kind of like the equivalent of West Point at one point in time, just before the First World War and just after. During the Second World War, it got more of an ominous thing, and that was Andrews Barracks. But they said that I could take pictures, and all I had to do was write stories. And I was like, but I've never written stories before. And they said, well, you got the gift of the gab. All you got to do is just put it down on paper and you should be all set. Okay, I'll try. And I'm not tooting my horn here, but I guess I did pretty well at it because I did it for like close to 2 years. You know, just taking down, sometimes I would get leads from other people. Like there was this one captain one time, gosh, I wish I could remember his name. And I don't have any of those stories left. I donated all my stories, the clippings that I saved, because I had a whole big, thick scrapbook full of stories. And this specialist from Signal Battalion, it was a Signal Company. Doesn't matter. All the companies were as big as battalions back then. The guy told me about this captain there at Signal Company who had to perform CPR on somebody during a training exercise. And shortly after that, about an hour or so after that, he got a phone call. His wife was in labor. So we thought it was pretty amusing, and I did a story on the guy and his wife and brand new daughter. As a matter of fact, they ended up in the story because it was kind of cool that the guy had saved somebody's life earlier in the day and then turns around and has a baby too. And we married the two up into a story, and it was a very nice piece. It's one of the ones I remember, that one. And and I had to do a Colonel Gard had asked me to take a photograph for the women's auxiliary of something up there, I don't know what, but it was, you know, mostly made up of the wives of the officers and whatnot. And they had this one of the generals was leaving. I don't remember which general it was, but they needed they wanted an aerial photograph of the house that the general and his wife had stayed in all that time when they were in Berlin. And this was the commander of the Berlin Brigade, not the USKOB. I guess he got the smaller bungalow. But it was a beautiful, beautiful home. And I knew it because I had played there in the combo several times when I was in the band. So the thing was, Major Urquhart, the commander of the aviation detachment, He took me up in the helicopter. This is the very first time I'm ever riding in a helicopter, mind you. He says, well, okay, Sergeant Johnson, it's right there. Can you see it? It's the one with the kidney-shaped pool. I said, sir, there's like four houses down here with kidney-shaped pools. I said, how am I to know which one? He says, all right, look, I'll fly right over it, and you'll know. And so he flies right over it. And then he tilts the helicopter 90 degrees, and my face was, he says, do you see it? I said, yes, sir. I started clicking the pictures real quick. I said, now, sir, can we put this this helicopter in the upright position? It was, oh, God, he had me crying. I was so sick after that. And we finally got out, and I kissed the ground. I literally kissed it. And him and his co-pilot were just laughing themselves silly. You know how pilots are. And then after that, we got to be as close of friends as an officer and enlisted man could be, because what ended up happening was Colonel Guard, every time he wanted a story on somebody or something down in what we used to call the zone, like they might be in Grafenwehr or one of those places. And Major Urquhart would take me down there, and I might stay 2 or 3 days to do a story on whoever we were doing a story on out in the field. And then he would come back, and it was all like they had to go down, like they had to bring some supplies down or something, whatever. And then I would just be part of, it wasn't like they made a special trip for me. And then like 3 or 4 days later, when they come back and take something, bring something down there or take something back, I was like cargo. They throw me in the back too, and we would take off. And I loved that part of the PIO gig, simply because you could learn about so many people and so many things. One in particular I remember, because now you have to remember back then, this was, 74, 75, somewhere in there, when this was the first time a woman was served. I mean, we still had the WAC, the Women's Army Corps, back then. They weren't completely called female soldiers at that point. They were still WACs. And Fort McClellan was the headquarters for them and everything. But I don't want to get off the subject too much, because then I'll forget what the heck I was talking about. So if you remember, well, most of us old-timers do, they gradually had the people come in, the women come in and start doing a lot of the jobs that only men were qualified for at the time. And this one specialist, I remember her last name was Okendo, and she was a Native American. I believe it was Hawaii. I'm 99% sure it was Hawaii, was her home state. And she was the first female to go out in the field, non-medical. This is just a person from Signal Company who happened to be in the field right alongside of her fellow Signal Company mates, but it was Signal, all the other Signal Company people. Here we go. And she was doing everything her MOS asked of a man she was doing too. So it was a very interesting story. Can't really remember too much of it, but I do remember the fact that she was the very first one to ever do it. And so that was basically news back then. And, I've been trying to think of all the stories I did, which ones stick out the most. And those were a couple right there. I can't really remember a whole lot of it. It went by so quick, and I had so much fun doing it. And a lot of these stories that I did, much to my amazement, ended up in the Army Times and the Stars and Stripes. And I thought that was really neat. And on top of that, the stories went into all, and of course they started with the Berlin Observer. That was the first and foremost thing I had. My job was to get stories about people in Special Troops Battalion and get them published in the Berlin Observer. And then I guess like the Army Times and the Stars and Stripes had people that would read the localized newspapers such as the Berlin Observer and maybe the Frankfurt Hot Dogger or something, whatever they have, whatever they called it down there. It was a situation where I just enjoyed myself thoroughly. And David, I think I just lost my train of thought completely.
Hey, that's all right. Good stuff. And what you were talking about was the Army Times and the local and people picking up the local papers and stuff.
That's right.
Yeah. So that's how they got wind of what you were doing in Berlin and all of that. That's pretty cool. So then from then it just went on to the Stars and Stripes, Army Times, and then anything bigger, anybody else pick it up? AP, UPI, anybody?
I'm not sure about the AP, UPI, but there were a few people where their local newspapers in the States would pick up on it because, you know, in some of these towns, this would be big news, you know. Oh, look at little Donna is doing this, or you know. I mean, in their mind's eye, it's somebody from the town who is doing something. But I'm trying to think real hard on the AP and UPI, and I don't think anything was ever picked up that big. Like I said, the biggest stories were the ones that went into the Army Times or the Stars and Stripes. And, you know, like there were a bunch of local, kind of like, I don't know if you recall when you were in the military, if you did something, they always had you sign a thing for the hometown newspaper, news release. That's what it was. And if, you know, this way here, they could public, like he was just finishing basic training. I remember the Philadelphia Inquirer. My mother snipped a little thing where my name was on there that I had just completed basic training at Fort Dix, New Jersey, blah, 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 and I was going into the 19th Army Band. I mean, little things like that, but whereas mine, in this particular case, or in all the cases, when I did a story about somebody, it was a pretty long story. I mean, it would cover several columns, if not several pages, and what would happen is the local paper would pick it up and just make a big story about it. And, of course, I never really got copies of any of that stuff. And like I said, if I didn't donate everything, I could sit here and go through that scrapbook. Oh, yeah, this one, and oh, yeah, because I remember, well, I had an educational experience. A story I had done, it was for the Bicentennial. And it was the 298th Army Band. I wasn't in the band at this point. I was the PIO. They had this big concert for the Bicentennial. And the thing is, they marched, I think it was from Andrews Barracks up to Berlin Brigade Headquarters. Yeah, up to Clay Alley. And then, if you remember, that's quite a distance. And it was just us, well, 298th Army Band, me taking pictures, and there were a couple other photographers there too, and an MP escort, basically. They had MPs, and the Polizei were also there with their blue lights, and we marched all the way from Andrews Barracks to BB, and then we had this big concert we had to play. But there was this big mural. In fact, I believe that mural may still be in the museum there. It was painted by an African-American fellow who happened to be, well, he was an infantryman. He was in the 6th Infantry, and he painted this beautiful mural about what we call Bunker Hill, the Battle of Bunker Hill that started everything, but actually it was Breed's Hill. Bunker Hill was the hill over, but, you know, history got a little bit mixed up, and it ended up being called the Bunker Hill Massacre or whatever. And the very first American shot during the Revolutionary War was an African-American, and I had no idea. His name, and to this day I remember the name, Crispus Attucks. And I said, wow, that's unbelievable. I mean, here I was all these years later, and I'm just finding this out. And I thought that was amazing. So, I mean, you learned a lot doing things like this. And the story about the guy was another one. And this one here happened to get into the Army Times and the Stars and Stripes and the guy's hometown newspaper, because it was a fairly big story, because the guy had come from nothing, joined the Army, making good, and he was this fantastic artist. And let me tell you, this mural he did was absolutely beautiful. But, I mean, it shows a picture of a black man being shot by a British soldier. And but, I mean, there were people. It was a very historical type of shot. He wasn't trying to make a statement. It just happened to be that way. And it was awesome the way this guy was an artist who could compete right up there with the best artists in the world. And I'd be surprised if he wasn't making a living doing that today. But it was a great thing that he had done. And, of course, the Bicentennial, holy cow, what a story that was in and of itself. And I didn't get to play in the band. And, you know, this is one time where I wished I had been there. But at the same time, here I was taking a lot of photographs. And so I should back up a little bit on this Crispus Attucks thing. The reason why we were having this parade and making a big to-do over it was that the mural that was painted by this young gentleman had to go from Andrews Barracks over to Berlin Brigade headquarters. And so the powers to be thought it'd be pretty cool if, you know, the band were to march behind this. It was an open bedded truck, which they took the mural and this thing was huge. It was probably, oh gosh, I don't know. It was huge. Anyway, they put it on the back of a truck and tied it down, or tied it up because it stood up. And then people could see the mural after the truck had passed. You could see the mural sitting right there, right behind the cab of the truck. And the band marched behind that, I guess, mainly to draw attention to the mural. And that was basically the whole gist of the reason why the band was being used and all that. And it's really something when you can be in your 20s and you learn about something like that. You had no idea that it happened. And what's a great thing about all those stories is they're finally being told. And in fact, I was talking with my son one day. You know, we were talking about history and the fact that they're just not telling you everything, and now they do, and it's great. But getting back to Berlin, yeah, those were some amazing stories that we did back in those days. The first woman to do this, the first woman to do that, the mural of the first person shot during the Revolutionary War. All the things you learned about, and some of the stuff that some of the women in Berlin were the first to do were amazing things. And of course, there were so many things in Berlin that needed to be done. I know we used to have the running joke that Well, I know if the Russians ever come crawling over the wall, I already got this big poster that says POW. I'm just going to hang it on my door and go back to sleep. And I used to laugh about that. But, you know, in a way, it was true. I mean, how much could we possibly do? We were only there as a show of force. And, you know, there wasn't very much else that we could do about it. But the nice thing was all the culture that the German people, and even I would say to a certain extent, our allies, including the Russians, would learn just from the fact of us all being in that city. That city, oh my gosh, it's a tremendous place. And today, I guess it's a heck of a lot different than when I was there. Just to drive down Unter den Linden through the Brandenburg Gate and then drive down to the Victory Column, which used to be Straße des 17. Juni. I don't know if it's still called that or if they decided to just extend the Unter den Linden down the through the Tiergarten there, because that's actually the main access through the Tiergarten. And so I don't know if they ever changed the name of that. Probably not, you know. But I thought it was pretty amazing. I was looking at some on the website. I was looking at a lot of the pictures that folks have submitted into the website. And to actually look at people standing, you know, regular people just standing at the Russian War Memorial is amazing, because back when I was there, all you could do was drive past it and don't even stop. Oh, if you stopped, there'd be 30 MPs. And well, I don't know about MPs. I think it was just the German Polizei that actually guarded that, because technically it was in the British sector. It wasn't even in the American sector. So it's just amazing to see people standing there, and there are no Russian guards anymore for obvious reasons. And, you know, it's something when you think about it, you got this war memorial that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for how many years? There were two Russian guards standing guard there, and now it's like, well, listen, we're all going home. We're tired of this. They just leave it there, and boom, away they go. You know, I'm still wondering if that we all went and saw that it was supposedly like the John F. Kennedy thing, the never-ending flame that they had. And I don't know if that's still lit. The one up there, was that Unter den Linden? I'm trying to think where the East German guards used to change every half hour, I believe it was. Used to come and do a changing of the guard, and that was in and of itself pretty amazing with the goose stepping and all that. While goose stepping isn't one of those things that we like as Americans, but I got to say, as a musician who has done drilling, you know, military martial, there we go, martial drilling, I think those are some pretty amazing things that they do with the goose step. And in fact, one time, here's a good story, and I did this as a PIO, not as a musician. We went up to Yugoslavia, and as the first United States military organization to ever enter the country of Yugoslavia, this was under Marshal Tito. He was still alive back then. And we went to, first we were at Dubrovnik. Oh, gosh, was that a gorgeous town. And we were all over the place. And it was nice and warm. This was, I believe, in February. It was so nice and warm. I said, oh, my goodness, here we are. We went south, and it's nice and warm. Anyway, we get to our target town. It took us like, close to 12 hours to get there by bus, over these little mountains that with these roads that were no wider than a toothpick. And I don't know how we did it, but we never toppled over the mountain. I thought we were a few times, but we didn't. Get up there, and we had to go to Sarajevo. And, of course, now everybody's heard of Sarajevo, but back then we're going, Sarajevo, what is that? Where is that? What's going on? So we get there, and it was so gloomy. We just happened to get there during a really bad day, weather-wise. And it was amazing that it reminded me so much of Berlin, you know, because of it being cloudy and it was a little bit of rain falling and everything else compared to Dubrovnik, where it was sunny and warm. It was cold and rainy in Sarajevo. And we actually did this humongous show in, it was a TV network thing that we were marching in, but it was huge. I guess it was built by the state. It had to be, because this hall that we did this thing in was huge. And every band played a different routine. It was kind of like if you've ever gone to a high school band competition, or a college band competition for that matter, or a drum and bugle corps competition. It was kind of similar to that. And I recall we were kind of embarrassed a little bit because we didn't really prepare for such. We just thought, well, you know, we'll go in and do this, that, and the other thing. But these guys were professionals. Oh, my goodness. The band, the Polish band, for instance. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't tell you. We were the first American unit ever to go to Yugoslavia. That's what we were told anyway. I'm not sure, but that's what we were told. And you had us, then you had the Polish army band, and we're talking about the main army bands, not like us. What the 298th Army Band, but we weren't a special band. We were what they call a line band. Meaning we were out there on the front lines, if you will. The Army has special bands like the Army Blues. Then you have the Army Field Band, the Ground Forces Band, and then the Pershing Zone, which is the Army Band. All of these bands are what you call your special bands. We were just a line band. And when we got there and we saw these other bands, there was a Czech band there and a couple of Yugoslavian bands. And all these bands were the main band or the second main band for their country. And so here we were. But, I mean, we held our own. And the great thing was that the Polish, I remember the Polish band in particular, they had to be, oh my gosh, you want to call, I don't know how they did it, but I mean the entire band is goose-stepping while they're playing. I couldn't figure out how they did that. I said, oh man, my teeth would kill me, my lips would kill me after doing all that stuff. But they did it, and it looked fantastic, unbelievably fantastic. And I just thought it was a very good band. I mean, sound-wise, I mean, which is 90% of it right there. But, I mean, not only did they sound great, they looked fabulous with the way they were marching and drilling. And then the exit, when they exited out of the arena, and the last guy out, of course, was the drum major. And, oh, my goodness, he goose-stepped on the way out, but he was balancing his mace
in the palm of his hand. I can remember him just holding the mace, the point of the mace, in the palm of his hand, and then the top of the mace. Now, the mace is like a big stick. Call it something else, I don't know. But it's a big, long, humongous stick, 6 feet tall, thereabouts. And he's balancing it, the tip of it, the pointy end, on his hand, while the end that has the big, huge, usually it's like a decorative ball that's on the end of the mace. And he's got it up there, and it just looked magnificent. And then he's goose-stepping on the way out with this thing balanced like that, and I just thought it was so cool. But it's amazing what you learn about other cultures. Now, I know everybody didn't have the same experience that I had, and I felt so fortunate that I was able to do that. One thing I recall about Berlin was every year we'd have to do this thing in February. It was called Grüne Woche, or Green Week. And all the country, there would be little, and it was held at the Funkturm, or the exhibition center there within the Funkturm. They had, every country would have a little area set out for them, and you had your, and each country took a theme and they went with that. And every year we used to play it, and it was just, see, I was in charge of the duty combo and the stage band. What basically that meant was I played a lot of jazz. And being in charge of those two units within the unit was really cool. So what would happen every year is we'd play for a week, just about. And it would be the duty combo and or the stage band. And most days it was just the duty combo, which was composed of 8 musicians. And we'd go there and play for several hours, take a break for a couple of minutes, and play again for several hours. But mostly, you know, we played the jazz that the German people, well, that anybody could recognize, you know, like In the Mood, Glenn Miller stuff, Benny Goodman stuff, that type of jazz. Nothing over anybody's heads, just the stuff that they can remember back, you know, in the 40s that they might have played. as you may remember, if you ever watched the movie Swing Kids, that music was very popular in Germany too, even back during the war. So it's, of course, it's still very popular to this day. And we had a thing with this Green Week where we would play, and it wasn't so much the actual concerts that we did, but when we used to take our little breaks, we had a lot of interaction with German. They would come up and they'd start talking to us about the music, then eventually about the United States and, you know, where we were from. And then the same thing with us, with them. We'd be asking them all the same questions. And the cultural exchange between the people of Berlin and the people of the United States Army was amazing. And it was in Berlin. I found this to be so very true. Whereas in a lot of other places, I can recall going places where they couldn't care less about Americans, America, or anything else. But in Berlin, it was much, much different. And I really loved the people in Berlin. One thing I had noticed, now, my German isn't the best, and I'm ashamed to say that because I was there from July of 73 all the way through to June of 1980, which is basically 7 years. Now, I only spent 8.5 years in the military before my left knee finally retired me out. But when I was there, the amazing thing was that you could talk with people, and if you learned German enough of it, the people many times would say, "That's okay, I speak English, and I think my English is a little stronger than than your German." And I would, you know, thank them profusely, and then we'd go on from there. But if you made an attempt at speaking their language, they would, you know, help you as much as they could. And I thought that was fantastic. And we had a lady, in fact, what got me involved with BerlinBrigade.com, but I didn't even know that the site existed. I don't know why. I mean, there's just certain things you don't think you're ever going to find online, so you don't think about doing a search. I'm trying to think of how exactly it was I come to learn about BerlinBrigade.com, but I can't remember. But somehow I landed there, and when I saw, you know, there was pictures and everything else, I was going crazy, and I said, "Oh my God, I've got to register and put my email address, and let's see who gets a hold of me." Because, you know, there are other places where I put my name, and then all of a sudden two or three guys or girls would pop out of the woodwork. And, oh my God, like Phil Cameron was one. This is a guy who I knew back in Berlin, back in the, during my first tour, which was in the early 70s, mid 70s, from the early 70s to the mid 70s. And he's from Texas. He's from the Dallas area, and played the baritone horn. And we knew each other, oh gosh, the whole time the two of us were in Berlin. In fact, he had met a girl there and decided to stay in Berlin instead of getting out. When he ETS'd, he stayed in Berlin, and he opened up his own restaurant. It was, in fact, I did a story on it for the Berlin Observer. Now, this story didn't get picked up by anybody else, but the Berlin Observer ran it, and it was about Phil and his girlfriend, who he eventually married, and they're still married today, as a matter of fact. And he opened up this restaurant, and it was the very first Mexican restaurant. And I mean, even myself being at the time I wasn't a New Englander, because like I was born and raised in Philadelphia, as I mentioned, and go Phillies. While we were there in Berlin, he had opened up this restaurant, and he sold nothing but, you know, genuine stuff, because like I said, he was a Texan, he knew how to cook all this stuff, and the restaurant became very, very popular, and he made a lot of money. Eventually he sold it, made even more money on the profits from the sale of the restaurant, that he bought another business, and so on and so forth. And then eventually he stopped being in business for himself, because he was kind of tired of doing it. Because, you know, when you own your own business, it's a 24/7 thing, and especially restaurants and things like that. But what he did was he got out from under all that, and he went to work for, you guessed it, Uncle Sam. He was working there at Tempelhof, because that's where the restaurant that he opened was, right there. Some of the listeners might know of a place called Snoopy's on the Red Baron Street. I used to call it the Von Riptocken Straße or something. I'm not sure of exactly how it was pronounced. He was right there on that street, and two doors down was Snoopy's, three doors down, something like that. So we used to get a lot of people that, you know, went by, and a lot of GIs, because they would be going to Snoopy's, and then they'd turn around and they'd see Mexican restaurant. Oh, boy, and they would go in. And I had never, myself, I had never had Mexican food, being from South Philadelphia. We don't, you know, there's not too many Mexicans in South Philadelphia, at least back then there weren't. And we went to the restaurant, myself and my wife, one day, and to give it a try. And Phil and his soon-to-be wife came out, and we talked for a while, and the food was absolutely fantastic. Now, Phil, you know, figured, well, I'll just stay another couple of years or whatnot. Well, here we are. What is this? 2010. Phil is still there. I had no idea that he was still there. 30-some-odd years later, we reconnect on BerlinBrigade.com, and last Sunday was the first time I talked to Phil in over 30 years and over 35 years. And we talked for 3 hours. And we could have gone longer, but, you know, certain calls of nature have to be honored. And it was just such a great thing to reconnect with somebody you haven't seen or heard from in 30 years. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. We talked for, and what's happening now is he's, since the Americans have left, he went to work. Like I said, I started to say, and I tend to wander, but he went to work for the Americans after a while, and he was working for the Air Force. A lot of stuff he did, he was doing banking, with the, I guess, American Express at the time, and then working in the for AFIS or AFIS or whatever you want to call it, and he was doing all these different things, and then finally he became the Class 6 store manager, and he was telling me how much he really loved that job, and what ended up happening was the military pulled out. Now he's without a job and everything, so he had to go back to making his own life for himself, and because he really wanted to stay in Berlin. He didn't want to have to come back to the States. So he's doing this thing now where he sells defensive military equipment and weapons and whatnot. And you see, they're very happy, and they're doing so well over there that... And he was telling me, he says, Bob, you would not recognize the place. Even if, he said, probably the only place you'd recognize would be Andrews Barracks. And here's another story that I'm sure everybody knows if they listen to your podcasts. The Andrews Barracks itself, they've, I mean, there have been changes made, but they're subtle changes, and... it's a protected site because of the historical nature of the buildings that are there. Like I said, Andrews Caserne goes way back. I don't remember exactly what the name of the caserne was before we dubbed it Andrews, but it was a deal where all the buildings there, you couldn't change them. And the funny thing was we had this... Oh, my goodness. We had this little gravestone that somebody, and this was back in the 50s or 40s, somebody that was in the band put this, it looked like a tombstone. It was a stone. It was like a slate stone. And they actually scraped into it. I don't know what they used to scrape into, because it's not a clean engraving. It's just a scraping. And basically it said, here lies Hermann the German, and he haunts this building. So be forewarned, or something to that nature. And then they gave him a born on and a death date, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's true. There's so many stories about sounds that occurred in the middle of the night. and nobody can account for them, but I'm sure there's an explanation. I don't believe in ghosts or anything like that, but everybody else in the band seemed to believe in them, and they always blamed it on Herman, the guy that was buried, supposedly. I mean, we actually had, well, not we, but the people back then, because I wasn't, heck, when they did this, I don't think I was even alive. The guys in the band at that time had given him a funeral and the whole nine yards. And to this day now, no one can touch that little grave that they made for Herman the German. It's got to stay there because it was part of the building when the state of Germany took it back over and made it a historical landmark. And so because it is a historic landmark, nobody can mess with it. It's, everything's got to stay in place just the way it was. And I thought that was, in and of itself, was a little too strict because, I mean, yeah, it's a historical building, but Herman the German really never existed. But I guess in the hearts and minds of everybody now, you don't have to worry about it. He's going to be there forever. Well, at least as long as they protect those buildings anyway.
So there you go. See, there you go about history. Now you've just told us the way it really is and what really is going on over there at Andrews Barracks. Because, hey, you know, history's got to go one way, and now you told us which way it's really going to have to be.
Yeah. I don't know what to say about McNair Barracks. The pictures I saw about McNair, oh my God, that looks sad. A lot of those buildings I had been in, especially the rec center there.
Oh yeah, yeah. And no, don't worry about that. A lot of the latest pictures that are up online about McNair is it's going to transition into a high school. So, yeah, so that's kind of what they're doing right now. Apparently, Lehman Brothers here from the United States and a German investment company got together. They purchased, my understanding, they're the last ones or next to the last ones. There might not be the current ones, owners, but what their intent was to go ahead and convert this into a high school. So what you're looking at is really the beginnings of the transition from military barracks to a high school, which is really a very good thing. The other, you know, they're not done yet, but things are looking very, very good. And you can see where things are going online for those of you that are interested. It's called Monroe Park after Marilyn Monroe. So apparently the McNair name is now going to be gone once the last remnants of the barracks is gone. So McNair and any reference to that's going to be gone. Even the clock tower is going to be called Monroe Tower. So that's going to be interesting. But the Four Ring, my understanding, is still keeping its name. So that might be one of the last little things to either change or not change to signify a presence of the Americans there in the on Gertz Alley and Fear the Jule Platz. So yeah. So what you're looking at is the transition stuff. So don't be too sad. I was sad when I first saw them, and when I went there in November and I saw, got in the buildings, walked in the buildings, just like a couple of others have since then. I was sad because it's like, you know, this is a big part of our life, and now it's becoming something else. But in the end, it's going to be something very good.
Well, that's great. That is fantastic. Absolutely.
Well, listen, let's steer this down. Okay, so you were there for like 7 years, and you left there in 1980. Tell me, you mentioned a little bit about missing, you know, the people of Berlin. Yeah, they are truly a unique people, those citizens of Berlin. So that's very good. What else do you miss? You know, first of all, tell us how things were. Where'd you go after you left Berlin, and then kind of what else do you miss Berlin, and we'll kind of go from there.
Yeah, so what had happened when I left Berlin finally in 1980, the Army decided to retire me because of my knee being as bad as it was. They decided that, I couldn't march anymore, obviously, so they decided to retire me, which I was actually thankful for in one respect, but very disappointed because I had planned on staying in the Army. Heck, if I could stay there for 30 years, I was going to stay. I was going to stay until they finally kicked me out. But, well, eventually they did kick me out, but it wasn't for something any good. So there I was in the middle of the world, not knowing anything but how to play the saxophone and how to take pictures and things like that, things that weren't really going to get me too far with a wife and two kids at the time, you know. So let me back up just a little bit. When I was in Berlin, I was taking saxophone lessons from a very famous jazz saxophone player, well, famous to us folks who play jazz. His name was Leo Wright. And he was the lead alto sax player for the Senders Frei Berlin band, the SFB band at the SFB studio down there in the British sector, right by the Fulcrum, as a matter of fact. Anyway, I went down there, and, well, what happened was my teacher, Leo, he had had a stroke, and he could no longer play. Now, what he did was he set up, he called the leader of the SFB band and said, listen, I got a perfect replacement for me, if you wouldn't mind. Maybe he can come down, audition, and you could see what he's made of, and you can decide for yourself if you want to hire him. And so I went, he recommended me. I went down there to audition, and I was accepted. And I said, oh, I was so happy. The only problem was I was going to have to, they were on hiatus, and they weren't coming back until October. Now, I would have had to go on from June to October with no income. That was impossible. On the German economy at the time, it was absolutely prohibitive. There was no way with a wife and two children. If I was by myself, I think I might have taken a chance. But in this case, no way. I had too many mouths to feed, and I couldn't do that. And it really upset me because to this day, I kick myself because if I could have done it, I would still be in Berlin playing a saxophone for the SFB Studio Orchestra, and it'd be just like being Tommy Newsom, which is the lead alto sax player for Doc Severinsen, back when Doc used to play for The Tonight Show. He was with the NBC Studio Orchestra, and it would have been the same exact thing. Money, like you wouldn't believe. Oh, the salary would have been incredible. And plus, you got 3 months, 3 months vacation per year. And, I was... But unfortunately, to make a long story short, I did not get that job. So I came back to the States, and here I was, back in the world, nowhere, nothing. I have no idea what I'm going to do in life. And I pick up the newspaper, and I start reading the want ads, and there was this ad, a big Burger King logo on it. It said, hey, we'll train you, et cetera, et cetera. And I had no idea that they took people without any kind of restaurant experience. So I went ahead and I put in for that, and I got the job. Well, I think they gave it to just about anybody who applied, to tell you God's honest truth. And I made out very well. And I learned how to run a Burger King restaurant. Next thing I know, within 7 months, I don't mean to toot my own horn, but in 7 months, I was a restaurant manager, which was unheard of. It usually takes a good 5 years before anybody becomes a manager, but I did it in 7 months. And I had a good time doing that, and learning how to run a multi-million dollar restaurant was really an experience in and of itself. Even though a lot of people go, yeah, well, that's just fast food. Well, yeah, let me tell you, it's a lot tougher than it looks. And I thoroughly enjoyed that, really, but it wasn't nearly as fun as my Army days. So what ended up happening was I did a bunch of stuff with Burger King. I managed a bunch of restaurants, became a district manager, the whole nine yards. And I made a lot of money doing that, but it wasn't all that fulfilling. But what happened, that injury to my knee got worse as I worked for Burger King. And one day, I was at a restaurant that was very busy, and the floor was wet. It had just been, the shake machine had just been set up. And the floor was wet from the sanitizer solution. And I went to wait on a couple of customers who had walked in. I went one way, my knee went the other. And, oh, my God, you could hear the scream. I think people in Berlin heard me screaming here in Dayville, Connecticut. And it was really bad. And from that day on, which was late 89. It was definitely late 1989. And then it carried over to 1990, and it kept going and going. I haven't really, really worked since that day in 89 when my knee messed up again. And then I ended up with back problems, and the other knee went. So I've got two knee replacements, one for each knee, obviously. And then my back has been fused, and I've got a lot of hardware. In fact, I've got more metal than bone in my lower from my lower back on down. I got more metal than I care to think about. And then while I was rehabbing, the reason why I give you all this, I had to do a lot of rehabilitation. I can't remember if it was for the knee or for the back. I was at physical therapy. And the physical therapist I had, and talk about fat chances. Well, this woman was from Germany, who I happen to have. And this was back in, 92 when the wall came down, whatever. The woman, we were sick because you know how they have these little TVs in hospitals. You can watch the TV while you're exercising or whatever. Well, we happen to be watching, and this is as the wall is coming down, and the people were dancing on top of it and everything, and right there at the Brandenburg Gate, of course, it was the most popular place to film, and I was telling the woman, I said, I was there in Germany, in Berlin. I said, right where those people were standing. I said, I didn't stand in that spot on top of the wall, but I was there. She says, oh, you were stationed in Berlin. So we started talking about that and everything. And I said, well, how do you feel about the wall coming down? And she says, terrible. I was shocked. I was absolutely shocked because, when we all served there, we all thought that, oh, this is the main thing that the German people want. But as it turned out, nobody thought enough ahead about the social ramifications, particularly Social Security and Medicare, their versions of all that. And how are we going to take care of all these people? You got a lot of old timers in that crowd. How are we going to do this? And of course, nobody thought ahead, and here they were stuck with the problem. And that's what the woman who, because she was from, I think she said she was from Dusseldorf. And she brought all this to my attention. I said, that's something I didn't think about either. I said, oh my goodness, you poor people, you got to try to absorb all these. I mean, it's like absorbing a whole new country into your country. And these people have not contributed one penny to the system, as it were. And so now here you have to, oh my goodness, what a mess, I guess it was. They did it. Obviously, but it's still a mess that they're paying for today. Everybody's getting together and trying to get everything back to where it should be for the people who started with all this, and also for the people who are coming into it brand new. So eventually, of course, you know, when the wall came down, completely came down that night, I happened to be, and here I was with a German woman here in Danville, Connecticut, at the hospital, doing exercises with the physical therapist. So that's what I was doing when the wall came down. And I just thought it was, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, what were you doing when Kennedy was shot? What were you doing when Dr. King was shot? What were you doing when this happened and that happened? And, you know, I still remember all those things that I was doing for all those events that occurred. And so that tells you just how meaningful that event was, especially in my life, knowing what I know and having been where I've been, you know, with Berlin. And I think it's just one heck of a town. And I don't know what else to say about it. It's just a fabulous place.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, it still is. It always will be. It always has been prior to all of the nonsense of the 30s and 40s. And you know, it's just been a magical place, and it will continue to be. Folks, for those of you listening, we've been talking to Bob Johnson, former member of the 298 Band and public information officer or public information office photojournalist there with the Berlin Brigade. And I don't know if this is coming through or not, but I do want to apologize. We've been having some technical difficulties. We've been hearing some little popping noises, and I've been looking at my feedback monitor, and it's not been pretty. So, again, we apologize for that. Bob on his end has been hearing it. I've been hearing it. So it's somewhere out in the internet where the problem lies. Bob, tell you what, you answered the questions, and thank you very much for that. Give you a little opportunity here. You know, I've got a question before we turn this or start bringing this to a close. You mentioned that the 298th Band cut an album. How does somebody get a hold of that? Is there's just like, you know, one for everybody that was at the band at that time and that's it? Or is it somewhere out there we could find it?
I believe they, what happened was, and we recorded it at RIAS, Radio in American Sector. We recorded it there, and it was great. The One Star General, and I remember this gentleman's name, William C. Moore. He and I, well, we were on a first name basis. He used to call me RJ. I used to call him Sir or General. But he really loved the band. And when I left Germany, when I left Berlin, there was no, I didn't get a copy of the album. And I really had forgotten about it till one day I received a copy in the mail, and there was a letter on it, taped to it, because, well, it was typical vinyl. It wasn't a CD. It was a huge thing that came in. And there was the One Star flag sitting on the very top of the letter. And I went, oh, this is from General Moore. What do you know? And he personally, and he wrote the thing that's all handwritten and everything. And he said, and I was so touched by that. But he had sent me a copy. Now, I don't know. There must be somewhere, like, I don't even think Radio in American Sector has shut down operations there. So I don't know how somebody would get a copy of it other than to ask Berliners, because the albums, I know they oh, my goodness, they copied. They must have. I remember the boxes coming in, though. There was case upon case upon case of albums. And I don't know where they all ended up. We basically cut this album, and I have no idea where somebody today could find it. I know I have a copy, but I can't burn 1,000 copies. In fact, I don't even think I have a turntable to play it on anymore.
Oh, I don't know if anybody that has a turntable.
Yeah, you could still buy them, but they're hard. to find. It's something you just never think about. But it's the album wasn't any great musical thing. What we did was on one side, we played a bunch of German marches and German tunes that they would know and love. And then on the other side, we played all American stuff. And like I said, nothing heavy, just your usual, what we used to call pop tunes. But of course, today they wouldn't be considered pop. Heck, they weren't pop when we were doing them. I mean, they were no longer on the charts. Basically, what we were playing was Glenn Miller stuff, Benny Goodman stuff, you know, that type of thing. And not really big on the musical hit parade or anything, but stuff that the Germans knew and loved. And and that's, after all, who we were recording the album for, was for them. And it was a very successful album, from what I understand, and the German people enjoyed it. And they got it for free. Exactly how it was passed out, I don't know. I have no clue. Or I don't even know, like, what the setting would have been to where they would have had these albums and were passing them out. Maybe, I would say, one place would have been the German-American Volksfest. You know, things like that. But other than that, I can't really think of a time or a place where they would actually sell these things, or not sell them, but give them away. And it was a good album. The engineer was excellent, and he knew his business, because and all of these guys I can remember back when I was doing the. PIO gig with the band and stuff. They used to have a guy, well, even when I was in the band, there was this guy named Rudy, I think it was Rudy Geller, who was the the main guy that used to travel around with the band from AFN. He was basically a camera guy. And then he would, you know, take names and all that other stuff, and then he would hand it to somebody at AFN who would, you know, report on it based on the names and story and whatnot that Rudy would give them. And it was pretty interesting. They made quite a few stories that ended up on the air. In fact, you know, I did a few things with the combo on AFN. And I had my own jazz program on Sunday nights. I only did it for like 3 months in Berlin, and it was pretty neat. You know, back then I had a better voice than I have now. My voice now is minus a thyroid gland, so it that's why you get this gravelly sound if you got it on your end. Hey, maybe the problems we're having with the audio has nothing to do with the computer at all. Maybe it's my gravelly voice that's doing it. I have no clue. But it really, I have to struggle with my voice sometimes to speak without it being so raspy. Was something we wanted to talk about, and now I'm trying to remember.
Basically, I think it was just, we're starting to wind down. You're leaving Berlin, and what you did after, you already mentioned about the fall of the wall. I think, you know, any closing remarks, comments, questions that you want to pass on, something we didn't touch on, something you want to expand on? I know we talked about the album. Hey, anybody out there, if you've got it, you've got this album, let us know. Just be something really neat to hear, to listen to. And hey, I think it would make good music, good bumper music for the podcast, and actually get the 298th band on there. Yeah. Instead of Pershing's own, you know, let him, he's already got his own. We need our own. So, if anybody out there in the 298th has that album, let us know.
Yeah, I have the album, but like I said, it might be, I'll see what my son can do with it. This won't be tomorrow, but because he's away at college, when he comes home this summer, I'll ask him if he could work on getting this, getting some recording, some type of recording of the album. And then, because I'm pretty sure I have a couple of turntables downstairs in the basement that he could probably use if they still work. And then, if you want, I could send you a couple of CDs or whatnot, and you can pick and choose and figure out what you want to use for the podcast. That would be great.
Oh yeah, definitely. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, greatly appreciated. Yeah, that would be nice. That would be a coup. That would definitely be a coup.
Yeah. Oh, sure. I didn't even think about that. But like I said, I do have a copy. If somebody else has a copy and can do all this stuff like tomorrow, well, that'd be even better. But I don't know. I really don't know if too many people actually have that album. I've got a recording, by the way, of it's a mixture between the stage band, which is a 20-piece big band, basically, and an 8-piece, what we used to call the duty combo, which I call the mainstream jazz octet. Both groups, we did this huge concert thing in Berlin just before, it was in May. That's how close it was, from May of 80. Just before I got out, I wanted to have one last hurrah. And what we did was, well, this was back the same year that Kenton died. 1979 was actually when he died. And most of the rehearsing we did from the end of 79, because we put a lot of rehearsal into this. It was 20 tunes, most of them done by the Stan Kenton band. And there was this big write-up about it in the Stars and Stripes. In fact, I still have that write-up. That's one write-up that had nothing to do with Special Troops, so I kept it, didn't donate it. It is a great recording, the recording I have, but it's not, I don't think it's anything, because it has no military bearing. Jazz type of thing, but if you ever want to use it just for the fact that it's a 298th Army band, I can definitely send you a CD. That's not a problem. I can burn you off a CD. I can do tomorrow. But everything else, I'm sorry, I don't have any equipment to do with that.
Oh no, don't you worry about that. Yeah, that popping noise is really still hanging around. So. That is just insane. Well, listen, I think we again, I know, did we miss anything?
I don't think so.
We've been talking today with Robert Johnson, who started out as a saxophonist with the 298th Army Band in July 1973, and eventually assigned as a photojournalist in the public information office for the Berlin Observer, and who had pictures and stories eventually picked up by the Army Times and the Stars and Stars and Stripes. and left Berlin in June of 1980. Thanks again, Bob, for sharing your awesome memories. It's been a pleasure, sir. Thank you very much.
Well, you're very welcome, David. And, hey, I have more memories, by the way, a lot more memories. So if you ever want to tap into my experiences again, feel free to do so.
Well, sir, just know the same thing. It applies. If you've got something to say, let us know. Just say, drop me a note. Say, Dave, got something to say, and we'll get you back on the podcast. It's an open invitation to join us here anytime.
All right. Very good. I'm sorry about the little interruption there. It was my brother trying to call me on my other line. Yeah, he's calling again. He's going to be persistent.
Yeah, that's all right. Again, thank you very much, Bob.
Okay, Dave.
Again, I want to thank Bob Johnson for joining us. If you happen to have a copy of the 298th Army Band album that we talked about in the interview, please let me know at davidg@berlinbrigade.com. Let's make some arrangements so we can get that listened to and shared with as many people as we can. It sounds awesome. It should be a lot of fun. So again, if you got a copy of that album, let us know. Well, the time has come to start wrapping up episode 21 of the BerlinBrigade.com podcast. Remember, you can always send us comments, concerns, questions, show ideas to David G. That's D-A-V-I-D-G at BerlinBrigade.com. Or you can stay up to date with the latest at BerlinBrigade.com by following us on Twitter at www.twitter.com/BerlinBrigade, all one word. Or join the BerlinBrigade.com MySpace page at the MySpace.com. Or you can do what over 780 other fellow Berlin Brigade members and supporters have done so far and join us on the Berlin Brigade fan page on Facebook by following the link on the BerlinBrigade.com homepage. All of us invite you to come and join all the great conversations we got going on. It's a great conversation. We have, like I said, we have over 180 members, and if you've been looking for a reason to join Facebook, now continues to be a great time to sign up and join our conversation. It's great. So listen, until next time, I am your host, Dave Guerra, former member, Alpha Company, 6th Battalion, 502nd Infantry. And this has been the 21st episode of the BerlinBrigade.com podcast. I thank you for listening. Stay safe. Goodbye.
The BerlinBrigade.com podcast is a Dave Guerra production. Thank you. Sergeant Major, dismiss the brigade.